Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Bull Publishers. This episode features author Adam Vels speaking about his latest book, The End of Eden, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown. Now, typically discussions on climate change highlight the adverse effects on human societies due to storms, droughts, and sea level rise. Yet it's the natural world facing a sixth mass extinction due to ecosystem disruptions and rising temperatures that bears the brunt of climate breakdown. This has endangered countless species, signaling a rapid loss of the natural world. The End of Eden navigates this narrative by offering a unique perspective on the struggles of wild species across diverse ecosystems globally. Through a mix of natural history, first-hand accounts, and modern research, Vels introduces us to the intimate struggles of several species against climate breakdown. This book stands out for its deep research and beautiful prose, aiming to foster a deeper human nature connection and urging action to protect the natural world. In this episode of PageCast, Adam is in conversation with Cape Talk Afternoon Drive host John Matham. Enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to another edition of PageCast. My name is John Matham and my day job is to host PM Drive on Cape Talk on Monday to Friday between 3 and 6 p.m. But one of my passions is both the environment and reading. So reading about the environment in its various guises is a huge extra special pleasure for me. My guest in this edition of PageCast is Adam Vels, who is, according to the back of the book, an enthusiastic naturalist and widely traveled environmental writer, photographer, and filmmaker. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Yale Environment 360, The Atlantic, Ensia, and many other outlets worldwide. And the book that we're going to be discussing is called The End of Eden, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown. And if I could preface our conversation by saying it is a very, very, very good book. So on that note, hello, Adam.
Hi, John.
Can we start with a little bit about you and your passion for the environment and how that developed? I mean, you make it clear in the book that you were a sort of hands-on natural environment explorer from a fairly early age.
Yeah, John, since I was a kid, I've been fascinated by all kinds of critters. Probably started with fish, I think. I was probably about 10 years old and I started keeping aquarium fish. And then I soon got very interested in reptiles, snakes. And as a young teen, I used to hang around with some friends. I grew up in Pretoria and we used to search, you know, abandoned lots and go onto the edge of the city and turn over trash looking for snakes. And after a while, I fell in with some scientists at the what was then called the Transvaal Museum, who used me as free labor for all kinds of studies. So I ended up learning how to catch birds to ring them and catching all kinds of reptiles and snakes in far off parts of South Africa and learning a lot, you know, from these older folks who were really interested in this. And I think, you know, it was a great liberation for me from, you know, being a teenager at the time in a, you know, 1980s state of emergency, apartheid Pretoria, being somebody who wasn't very interested in being a sort of white supremacist and so on. It was a great outlet, you know, from the general sort of oppressive vibe, if you like, of white Pretoria society at the time. It was a great outlet to be able to, you know, just connect with all these wild creatures and learn about them and find out, you know, these absolutely fascinating worlds that they inhabited. And I've been interested in living creatures ever since, you know.
People have childhood passions which might become young adult, mature adult, late age adult diversions from their day jobs, but you decided to convert that childhood passion into a lifelong professional career. How did that develop?
Yeah, so I landed up doing an undergraduate degree, a Bachelor of Science at Rhodes University in botany and zoology, But at the time that I finished in the early 90s, the options, the career options on the table were to sort of spend the rest of your life in a lab doing DNA stuff, which didn't really appeal to me, or become a game ranger. And unfortunately, game rangers got paid unbelievably badly in those days. And I looked at the salaries on offer and decided that even as a non-materialistic person, like I am, that was too little money. And I actually ended up going into the media. One of my other passions was photography. And in the mid-90s, I ended up going into photography. I was a fashion photographer for a while. I produced fashion shoots for foreign companies. I then ended up working for magazines and traveling around the world. I lived in the UK, lived in later on in Taiwan, traveled a lot in India, Madagascar, and places like this, just sort of moving around. And eventually in the sort of mid-2000s, after having done an honors degree in ornithology at UCT, I landed up writing for a living more by accident than anything else. And I started making my, passion for the environment and for ecology and for, conservation, into a living. And so I've been in the media most of my career, but in various parts of the media, I've made documentary films. As I say, I've been a photographer. More recently, mostly a writer, environmental consultant, and so on. But the question that I'm interested in answering in nearly all my work is, how do we save species? And that's what led really to this book. I heard that a big publisher in America was casting around looking for a book about climate change and nature, because so much of the work that has been published on climate change is about, climate change and people. And so I reached out to them and I worked out a proposal, and they took it. And this is where this book comes from, because I think climate change is a very underappreciated threat to wild species. And I really wanted to look into that, and that's what I've done.
And I think we are all the richer for your having put that proposal together and the publisher having accepted it. You've used the phrase climate change, I think, four times very recently in your answer to me. And yet, one of the striking things about an extremely striking cover of The End of Eden is two words in its subtitle, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown. So in the book, you talk about climate breakdown. And of course, in the book, you explain why you talk about climate breakdown and climate change. But for the purposes of PageCast, why do you prefer that phrase?
I often will use the term climate change when I'm introducing myself or talking about the book at the beginning, because that's a term that, is in wide use. But I'm not a big fan of it. As you say, I do prefer the term climate breakdown. Because climate change to me can sound kind of wishy-washy. It's like, oh, it's a change. And if it changes in one way, maybe we can sort of change it back again. But actually, what's going on is, climate, as we understand it and we learn about it in school and so on, climate is really a structure, right? It's something that's predictable for certain places. You can make generalizations like, in Johannesburg, the winter climate is like, dot, dot, dot. And it's a structure. In time and in place that we have built, modern civilization around the last 11,000 years or so, that scientists generally call the Holocene epoch, is an era in which climate has been incredibly stable, and we've managed to build settled civilizations around it because we can create agricultural fields. We can do settled agriculture in a stable climate because it's predictable, because we've learned to understand the structure and use it. And we're breaking that structure now. And the structure is breaking down, not in a way that's somewhat just reversible. And I think we need to really accept that, and accept that we're moving into an era, not just where climate is changing a little bit, but where it's becoming incredibly unpredictable. And and the structure as we've known it and come to accept it in our cultures and our languages and our moral frameworks is increasingly something of the past.
Adam, before we get into the detail of the book, I entered the book as somebody who acknowledges and is very concerned about climate breakdown and how little, it's all very well me as a concerned climate activist, if I dare glorify myself with that term, doing the things that I can to reduce climate breakdown. But ultimately, it's structures, it's global systems that need to act in a more accelerated way than they're acting at the moment. And so I enter the book as somebody who is prepared to take on board what you tell me. What it does is it adds texture and detail to a narrative that I already implicitly believe in. How important is it, do you think, for people to try and persuade the skeptics, the doubters, that this thing is real and it's scary?
Yeah, John, I mean, this is a tough question that a lot of people grapple with. I think there's a certain percentage of people on Earth that are so entrenched in a belief system that, that cannot countenance the idea that the climate is changing, is breaking, and we are the cause. They're so entrenched in that you're never going to reach them, and speaking to them about climate change is honestly is a waste of time. I don't believe in spending inordinate amounts of energy trying to persuade hardcore climate deniers that climate change is real. But I think there are a large number of people that are not convinced of the extent of the danger presented by climate breakdown, and honestly, who don't really understand how it works. Basic ecological education is not really out there in the world very much. Schools generally do a terrible job of teaching folks the basics of how the global systems work. And what I'm doing with this book is I'm telling people's stories about species, and I'm explaining the science behind what's going on with these species as they confront climate breakdown. But I'm deliberately using language that folks who have never spent a day in an ecology class can understand. You know, this book is really written for everyone. And I'm hoping to reach the people that are climate curious, let's put it that way, who are interested in knowing more, who might be skeptical of some of the details, who might not fully grasp the scale of what is going on through these stories. And I think the other point that I make at in the final chapter of the book, which I think is really important, is it's very easy as a sort of regular person to walk into the media maelstrom that exists around climate and walk out very confused, right? There are loads of very sophisticated bad actors out there. There are just massive, financial interests here. You know, the fossil fuel industry is an incredibly large industry that has never shown, any regard for human rights or sort of morals or any of these things as we understand them. And the fossil fuel industry, does not want to give up the trillions of dollars that are on the table if we continue to burn fossil fuels. And, these are folks who will do anything really to hold on to their profits. And they've rolled out very sophisticated, media campaigns and so on to make people doubt the science and the actuality of climate breakdown. But what I say to people is, you don't have to really trust any of these people out there. You don't have to trust the deniers or the scientists or anything. What you need to do is pay attention to what's going on around you. If you start learning the names of the creatures that inhabit your environment, the wild species that inhabit your environment, the birds or the butterflies or the plants or whatever it is, and this can be in your backyard or this can be in a nearby park or a nature reserve. It doesn't have to be in a deep wilderness area. If you just start paying attention to the creatures that are in your immediate environment, and you start that by, you know, learning their names, which is not terribly hard to do, you will soon see for yourself that things are changing, as I have seen for myself that things are changing and that, you know, climate breakdown is real. You know, I live on the South Peninsula of Cape Town, and I, obviously I've been a bird watcher since I, you know, as I say, I was a young teenager. And I'm constantly paying attention to the birds in my yard. And it's fascinating to see how, for example, migrant birds, the timings are changing. You know, birds that, you know, would normally get here in sort of mid-spring are now arriving in early spring. Some are leaving later than they used to, you know, as things warm up. Some birds are not really migrating at all anymore because they don't have to. They're not being forced out by cold weather. You know, I've watched just in my area, strangely, how speckled mouse bird, which used to be the common mouse bird here that I would see multiple times a day in my yard, just in the last 3 years or so has been almost completely replaced by a red-faced mouse bird. I hardly ever see speckled mouse bird here anymore, and I'm seeing red-faced 3-4 times a day in my yard. And that's telling me that something is changing in the environment, you know. And again, generally speaking, red-faced mouse bird is a species that tends to favor drier areas than speckled mouse bird does. So is that telling me something about how the climate is maybe heating up and drying in Cape Town, you know, as the scientists are predicting it will, you know, and of course, we've just been through the driest summer in 25 years. So not to sort of belabor the point, but honestly, if you just start paying attention to what's around you, you don't have to believe anybody. You will see for yourself. You will find your own data, if you like, in your own environment that will tell you, that will confirm that what the vast majority of scientists have been saying for decades now, the climate is changing. It's becoming way less predictable, and it is due to primarily to our emissions of fossil fuels and, you know, related land use changes, for example, which also release a lot of heat-trapping gases into the atmosphere.
How much does the final book, The End of Eden, I picked it up and read it cover to cover with with great enjoyment, if that's the right word, and also with mounting alarm. And how much does it differ from the original proposal you put forward? Because, again, something you do say in the book is that you were kind of learning on the job, as it were. And I entered page one thinking I knew a bit about this. And by the end, page the last, I realized how little I knew.
I would say writing the book was a really difficult and process that resulted in some, you know, pretty serious sort of personal transformation. Because, as I say, I've been interested in nature since I was a kid. I've been involved and reading about and doing stuff around climate probably for 20 years. You know, I've never been a doubter of the science. But I think it's such an overwhelming, massive thing to really try and sort of wrap your psychological arms around, that even people who are involved in climate, even climate scientists, many of them themselves, kind of keep it at a psychological distance. And writing this book forced me to really look at, in not just in figurative terms, but in literal terms, the impact of climate breakdown on the natural world. And I traveled to quite a few places to report on this book. You know, I went to California, where a lot of changes have been happening recently in the landscape. And I saw areas for myself where just unprecedented wildfires have wiped out just incredibly large areas of forest and transformed those ecosystems literally overnight from forests into scrublands. I went myself into the deserts of Southern California, the Mojave, Death Valley, and so on, and saw for myself how lizards are disappearing from the hotter parts of those deserts. I literally saw lizards that were emaciated, that were starving to death in areas where 10 years before they'd been thriving. I noted that birds were disappearing in those areas. I went to Puerto Rico and the Florida Keys to see the impact, the aftermath of the hurricane season of 2017, which still is devastated those areas even years on. I went to Australia to see the aftermath of the Black Summer bushfires of a few years ago. And doing all of this and reading all of this, I mean, there was a point at the middle of the book where I just couldn't write anymore. I was just frozen up, honestly, and trying to confront the enormity of all of this, because it's a little bit like having your face rubbed in it all the time, and then after a while you just can't ignore it anymore, and it's devastating. And I've seen a lot of climate scientists and a lot of climate activists when they're forced to confront what their work is telling them, and they could just no longer deny the enormity of it, it can be sort of psychologically very, very difficult. And I certainly experienced that myself. It's a kind of a horror that you have to try and get through somehow, you know. So writing this book, forced me through that process, which was really hard, but I'm now incredibly glad to have done it. You know, it's empowering. I think people feel respected when you tell them the truth, even if that truth is very difficult. And there's a sort of maybe an initial period of immense sadness and all of these things that might, these, let's say, what we might characterize as negative emotions that you might experience. But afterwards, honestly, I feel more empowered. I don't feel necessarily any more happy about the future, let's put it this way. But at least I feel like I know what's going on. You know, I feel kind of grounded in an appreciation of this uncertainty, as paradoxical as that might sound. But yeah, so that's a long answer to your question. But yeah, it was a really tough process, but I recommend it, as strange as that might sound.
Adam, you mentioned in your last answer, which might have been long, but it was fascinating, fire. And fire is something which has always been part of us, but primarily it's kind of acted as a stabilizer of ecologies. And that is, as your book so poignantly points out, is changing. And there are a lot of books being written about fire at the moment. I think of John Vaillant's book, Fire, yeah. Weather, A True Story from a Hotter World, which looks at the 2016 fire in Fort McMurray in Canada. And fire is important to the ecology of that part of the world where both you and I live because of its role in the Fynbos kingdom. And yeah. I mean, fire is really becoming, perhaps people are starting to understand and appreciate and analyze and write about, but I don't think citizens understand just how much the world of fire is changing, and through its changing, is changing the world in which we live.
Right. As you say, yeah, fire is a really important factor in a lot of ecosystems around the world. It shapes a lot of ecosystems, certainly, across much of Southern Africa, nearly all our systems involve fire in some way or another. You know, fire has shaped ecosystems, and in turn, ecosystems have shaped fire. You know, it's a force within these ecosystems that they've adapted to, and which a lot of ecosystems need now. I mean, again, the Cape Fynbos, the most diverse temperate ecosystem on Earth, around Cape Town is very much fire dependent. Fire has been a part of this place for tens of millions of years. As I point out in the book, there are fires and then there are fires. Fires are not all the same. Fires behave differently depending on the weather that is around at the time that a fire occurs, depending on the vegetation that it's burning through, depending on how broken the landscape is, and so on and so forth. And many, many ecosystems have adapted to certain types of fire, by which I mean perhaps they've adapted to cool fires in the late summer, for example. But what we're seeing now due to climate breakdown and various other environmental changes that, happening at the same time, is that fires are taking on very different forms than they used to. In many places, they're coming a lot more often than they used to. And in many places, they are much bigger and way more intense than they used to be. In other words, they're burning faster, they're burning much, much hotter. And this is causing just, you know, massive changes to these ecosystems. And, you know, this is not your granddad's fire, if you can put it that way. And I do get into that in the book. There is a chapter on fire. I tell some stories. And again, what I hope with this book is that I've told enough stories of enough different places and enough different species that people can walk away and say, right, oh, I understand how this works now. I understand why, for example, the forests are disappearing in California, you know, because of fire. And because I've understood that story, I can now understand that similar stuff is happening in other ecosystems elsewhere in the world. In other words, I've selected a handful of stories, you know, that I tell in this book. Each chapter really just focuses on a small number of species. I tell you their stories, but I want you to understand, again, how these things work for those species, and so that you can take that as a, let's say, project it on or put it onto another place in the world and understand how that's going, you know, how that might happen there. Yeah. You know, and I very much try to do this with fire. Fire, yes, is changing in a lot of places around the world. And as you say, it's becoming a hugely influential force in places that it really never was before. And that's resulting in massive ecological changes. And that's true for South Africa as well. You know, we had those devastating fires not too long ago in the sort of Knysna area. I was just speaking to ecologists a couple of months ago, and they're looking for exactly that same fire to happen, maybe a little bit further west now in the coming years. We're sitting on fire time bombs, you know, all over Southern Africa, because of invasive species, because of the change in climate, because we haven't fully understood the real implications of what it means to be inhabiting this totally different world than, you know, what it was just a few decades ago.
Can I ask you to tell one story? As you pointed out, each chapter deals with a particular area, a particular theme, and uses a couple of species to tell that story. So what do you want? The Puerto Rican parrot? Do you want the cheetah in Namibia? Do you want the yellow-billed hornbill in the Kalahari? Which one would you like? Because I don't want to give people everything that's in the book, because then they won't buy it, and they must. So choose the story and tell it.
Yeah, you know, John, as you say, each chapter has a kind of a theme, like one of the chapters is on fire. You know, I have an oceans chapter, another chapter deals with plagues and diseases, another one deals with extreme weather and so on. And I pick a species and a place, or some species and some places, to, you know, tell these stories that relate to the theme of the particular chapter. One of my favorite stories is a story about a bird called the Afro-Siberian Red Knot. This is a bird that breeds in the high Arctic, far northern Siberia, and migrates to West Africa in the northern winter when it can't be there anymore because everything is, you know, frozen and there's no food to be found. And it's a story about how, as the Earth has been warming very rapidly in recent decades, the Arctic summer, the Arctic spring snow melt has come earlier and earlier every year. And now these birds, these red knots, have always timed their northward migrations to arrive on the tundra just as spring snow melt happens. They lay their eggs and their babies hatch just at a time when the insect populations on the tundra also start exploding, you know, after everything has melted. And so their babies have always had very good protein supplies in terms of these insects, booming insect populations, which have sort of peaked at exactly the time as the babies have always hatched. But now that the spring snow melt is coming earlier and earlier, insect peaks are coming earlier and earlier, which means that the insect populations now peak in the north before the baby red knots have really hatched. And what this means is baby red knots now are malnourished. They don't get as much insect protein as they used to just a few years ago. As a result, stunted. And this is kind of okay in the sense that they're just a little smaller than normal. They don't die up in the north. But a few months later, once they've flown all the way across Europe and they land up in the coastal wetlands of West Africa, they confront a problem because they've always fed on these little clams that live just under the mud, and they find their beaks are just a few millimeters too short to reach good numbers of clams, which means that over the next few months in West Africa, about 90% of the youngsters in any given year now starve to death. For me, this is an illustration of just how a relatively small change in seasonal timing can have serious impacts on a species thousands of kilometers away and months and months later. How subtle the relationships are between climate and many wild species.
And then the future. I've just finished a book called Not the End of the World by a relatively young data scientist from the UK called Hannah Ritchie. She's 30 years old, and she's the deputy editor of Our World in Data. She's a senior researcher at the University of Oxford. And she says that planetary damage could be about to peak. She, for much of her late teens and 20s, felt very anxious and hopeless, like the problems were unsolvable. But she is now starting to believe, and that belief is informed by the data, that the world might be reaching overall peak pollution and that a more sustainable future could be secured. Would you share that cautious optimism?
You know, John, people often ask me a question like this at various book talks and speeches and so on that I do. You know, they ask me a question that's somehow about hope or, you know, the future. Do you have hope for the future? My response to this is always, this sounds like a cop-out, but it isn't. It's like, why are you asking me that question? Why do you want to know if there's hope, in a sense? It's like, do you want me to tell you, oh, yeah, there's all this great technology, all this great green technology that we've got lined up, and it's all going to get rolled out, and, you know, we're heading in the right direction, and don't you worry, we'll figure this all out, you know, quite soon. In other words, give you a sort of a sense of optimism and what have you, which allows you to go back and sit in the corner and do nothing, right? Because it's all going to be handled. The smart people, the technology, the what have you is going to sort this problem out. You know, or I could tell you, you know, John, all the indicators are going in the wrong direction. It's really bad. The stuff that's going on is devastating. And honestly, I don't see things turning around, and you know, I don't really have a whole lot of hope. You know, there's this option, if you like, to adopt this doomist mindset. You know, if I tell you that everything is terrible and there's, you know, there's no hope, and just go and, again, just sit in the corner and do nothing and kind of nihilistically wait for the world to end. But, you know, my response is really try and examine why it is that you're asking this question, because my feeling about it is, all the indicators that matter to me that I see are actually still going in the wrong direction, despite our technology that would enable us to reduce emissions. Emissions are still going up. Global temperatures are still going up. Maximum temperature records are still being smashed in all sorts of places. Species, many species are still in deep trouble and heading towards extinction. And, you know, what is needed is really just massive, massive, multifaceted action. And this is really, really hard. But it requires people to really start rethinking their lives, which is really, really hard. But that's my answer. You know, that's what needs to be done, is we need to rethink just about everything. And the positive aspect of that, though, which I point out in the book, is if we're really going to handle the climate crisis and the biodiversity crisis and the economic inequality crisis and any number of these other, you know, crises, which collectively make up maybe what we could call a polycrisis, you know, we need to change just about everything about the way we live, which means that just about anyone can get involved and do something. You know, and for me, that's the positive message, if you like, that comes out of this. I don't think we're either on track for total doom or total success. I think we're in a very, very uncertain space at the moment. A lot will depend on our actions.
I have been talking to Adam Welt, author of The End of Eden, Wild Nature in the Age of Climate Breakdown. I would describe it, and I don't do this often, as a book that must, should be read. Adam, thank you very much indeed. The book is available in all good bookstores. It's published by Sigma.
Thanks, John. Thanks for chatting.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.